Okay, good. I have chosen to call what I'm about to say the thread of all sorrows and mythic happiness. And it starts with a poem that many of you, if not all of you, have heard probably a lot of times. Before you know what kindness really is, you must lose things. Feel the future dissolve in a moment, like salt in a weakened broth. What you held in your hand, what you carefully saved, all that must go. So you know how desolate the landscape can be between the regions of kindness. How you ride and ride, thinking the bus will never stop. The passengers eating maize and chicken will stare out the window forever. Before you know the tender gravity of kindness, you must travel to where the Indian in a white poncho lies dead by the side of the road. You must see how this could be you, how he too was someone who traveled through the night with plans and the simple breath that kept him alive. Before you know kindness as the deepest thing inside, you must know sorrow as the other deepest thing. You must wake up to sorrow. You must speak to it until your breath catches the thread of all sorrows. And you see the size of the cloth. You must speak to it until your breath catches the thread of all sorrows, and you see the size of the cloth. Then it is only kindness that makes sense anymore, only kindness that ties your shoes and sends you out into the day to mail letters and purchase bread. Only kindness that raises its head above the crowd of the world to say, it is I that you've been looking for, and goes with you everywhere, like a shadow or a friend. So we've been talking a little bit, we've heard a little bit about the notion of a mythic context, and I've been thinking about the notion of a mythic context, and I looked up the word context in the Oxford English Dictionary, and it has a Latin word root that's contextualized, which means to weave together. And the definition, the colloquial definition, according to the Oxford English Dictionary, is the circumstances that form the setting for an event, statement, or idea, and in terms of which it can be fully understood. I'll say that again. The circumstances that form the setting for an event, statement, or idea, and in terms of which it can be fully understood. So these are the circumstances that mean that you can fully understand whatever this idea, whatever this statement, or whatever this event is. It brings full meaning and full understanding. So I was thinking of what this might mean in terms of mythic context, and it occurred to me that the idea that is being fully understood is self. That we have this kind of elusive idea of self that goes around taking different forms, throwing all kinds of doubt, upset, indecision, pursuing things that aren't that great for us. All kinds of things happen because of this elusive notion of ourself. We have some kind of selfish understanding of ourselves and the world that creates a lack of full understanding. And going back to the Latin word, we could say that we're constantly weaving this context together. We're weaving together some kind of image of the world with us at the center of it. And we don't fully understand because of this weaving together. So I had this idea that the mythic context is something that helps us, in Viradama's words, leads from one way of understanding and appreciating life to a different, deeper, and more alive way of being. I got that from your notes, Shantanu, Viradama. So, we have one context, which is us at the center of it, where we're somehow having a fixed identity or a fixed view of ourselves and the world that we've woven together. And I'm going to try and speak to the idea that there is another kind of context, a different context, one that doesn't have us at the center of it, that doesn't confuse us, that leads to a more alive way of being, a different way of understanding ourselves and the world. I thought I could reference the idea of, you know, a cyclic existence, one where we measure our happiness by the gap between what we want now and the way things are now. So we measure our happiness by how small that gap is. What we want right now and what we have right now. So we're always measuring our happiness in that way, potentially. Not always, but if we are doing that, it just leaves us in a kind of cycle, back in on the things that we thought we wanted, and we thought we had. Either that or the moment is quite nice and then it's gone. Pretty standard Buddhist teaching. So there's that. That's one way of having a context. And the other way of having a context, in some way, and this is the rub, we're trying to figure this out. We're all trying to figure this out, but we're trying to find some kind of context that creates a happiness which, rather than leading back on itself to unhappiness, forges meaning and contentment out of all the ups and downs of life. Some kind of context that can make some kind of mythic happiness out of everything we experience. It's a nice idea. We hear all kinds of things like more creative, less reactive, leading out of the same old thing and into uncharted waters. I like that one. So, what is it that that we make a self out of? Traditionally, it's one of five things. We either make a self out of form, out of feeling, out of our conceptions, out of our choices, or even out of the very self-centered consciousness that we find ourselves in. And I think, I was thinking about this, and I was thinking how at any given moment, the way in which we become selfish, or the way in which I become selfish, I would say most of my selfishness comes out of a sense of feeling. You know, if I feel better in a situation, I think that situation is for me. It's more the one that I want to be in. It just happens. I tend to want to be in a situation where I feel better. I was thinking about conception, meaning my ideas about the world. But actually, it all kind of comes back to feeling, because if I like what I'm thinking, I like how I'm feeling. But I think this is something for exploration. So we're always exploring. What is it we're getting stuck on? What is it that we think that we can't move beyond? What is it that is creating an undue amount of pull on us, you know, that's making us feel trapped in a way of being? You know, are we pursuing certain feelings or certain forms of experience, certain sense pleasures? Or are we just so wrapped up in our own way of seeing from time to time that we don't open up to other friends or family? Or I've been thinking about this a bit this afternoon. I've been having a lot of difficulty with my brother who lives next door. And I don't want to get into all the particulars, but he's at a really rough time in his life right now. And I was hearkening back to the cruel things that I did to him when I was a little boy. I mean, I don't want to blame myself for his situation, but all of a sudden it dawned on me that I haven't always been very nice to him. And in fact, when he asked me to teach him meditation 10 years ago, I didn't have the time for it. And it kind of upset me to have that thought, because right now I thought, wow, if I'd had time for it, maybe he'd be in a better place right now, instead of the kind of somewhat downward spiral that he seems to be in. And it's too bad that often we only see these things after the fact, if you know what I mean. So, getting caught up in your own stuff and not seeing the opportunities to be with and help others, or at least not be cruel to them, which is what I can remember doing to my little brother when I was 11 years old and he was, say, 5 or 6. I really was quite cruel in a number of instances. And he even mentions it to this day. And I'm only bringing this up to say that this notion of the thread of all sorrows is pretty deep. And it starts with the sorrows that we've sown. It isn't abstract. There's sorrows all around us that we have some part in. And we don't have to beat ourselves up over it, but it's very humbling to know the potential amount of suffering that I'm involved in. And to know it actually makes me less likely to want to call any one of these 5 things something fixed and a self, to hang on to it. So it recontextualizes things for me personally, this idea of the thread of all sorrows. And this is just one doorway into, I think, a mythic context, but this is the one that I want to speak to right now. That somehow being aware of sorrow in this way is a way of accessing mythic happiness, letting go of all the levers by which sorrow is perpetuated. It's sort of like if we're hanging on to our own self-centered view, we can't see it. It's like we're standing on top of it, so we can't look at it. And the more you let go, the more you can see the pain and sorrow that your sort of separate selfness actually causes. So that's good. How are we going to cultivate a mythic context? The second part of my talk is actually going to be about the 5 Buddha Mandala as a model for approaching this letting go, this great letting go, this great mythic happiness. It's like finding it's a kind of map for mythic happiness, I think. And it goes like this. There are five kinds of corresponding wisdom for the five kinds of self-centered self-identity, fixed self-identity. So I think we have to work this out in our own way, but the idea is that with our form, so form is, you know, the objective side of all of our sense experience. Taste, touch, smell, what the mind takes hold of, etc. And they can, at any given moment, cause us all kinds of grief. But they can also cause us to hang on to our experience in a way that's going to cause us or others grief in the future. And there's this ever-present potential to just see it as it is, to not see it as it will be or as it is for us at the moment, in the moment, but to just experience it with what's called mirror-like wisdom, to just stop, for a moment and be cold, in a certain sense cold. Cold but warm to the incredible panoply of experience that is actually impinging upon us in any given moment. And seeing it just as it is, not as it is for us or for the past or for the future, but just as it is, mirror-like wisdom. That there's some access that gives us to a mythic context, actually. One that gives you a view into the Buddha's mind. The next one is with regard to feeling, and it's the wisdom of sameness, or universal sameness. So, if you step off from the mirror-like wisdom and start recognizing what you like and what you don't like, start experiencing a pull towards a particular experience and an aversion for another experience, there's another kind of wisdom accessible to you. So what I like about this is that these wisdoms are kind of progressive in this way, the way I'm describing it. It's like if you don't get on the train here, you can get on the train here. If you don't get on the train here, you can get on the train here. The wisdom train, so to speak. So the next wisdom train is the train of sameness. So you see with a kind of clarity, and again, you catch the thread of all sorrows. You see that each arising preference of likeness, the things that you like, the pleasure, is the same as the sorrow. It comes and it goes. There's just this experience and then the next one. And that the more you kind of stay with that, you see that one moment causes its experience and the next causes another. And they're all the same in the sense that they're conditional, they arise in a particular way, and then they're gone. So there's this wisdom that arises, the wisdom of the sameness of all things. Now, if you don't get on that train, and you're in the situation where you're perceiving the particularities of your situation, yourself. So you are a particular person who experiences your own particular preferences and acts upon those particular preferences in some way which may be helpful or may be harmful. And as Dhanadasa said yesterday, you're just right. You, as you are, you're just right. That's it. This is who you are. And there's a loving kindness in that, one that just knows that this is who you are and this is what you are right now. And this is true if this conception is about another person, it's also true about them. This is equally true about any being within your conception. So, it's a moment of kindness and acceptance It arises, knows a thing just as it is, loves that thing just as it is. Complete acceptance and well-wishing, but a spontaneous well-wishing, not the kind you work for, a kind that just knows this is how it is and allows for a kind of spontaneous well-wishing. This is known as distinguishing wisdom, distinguishing or even particular wisdom. And it's usually associated with the word perception but I like the word conception. I've decided to replace perception with the word conception, and I'll tell you why. Because experiences are born, and conception is also a word for being born. Or I shouldn't say experiences. I mean, the way we perceive things are sort of born out of our form and feeling. They come together. We weave them, like I had said before about context. We weave the way we experience ourselves and others together. It's a conceiving. And it doesn't necessarily correspond to concepts. We conceive of a thing out there, like a person coming towards us, before we even name them, before we even figure out that they are a good or a bad person. So we're kind of barraged by these conceptions. They're just born forward. And the idea is that this distinguishing wisdom can take on whatever those conceptions are. That's what I'm trying to say. So as they're born, we know they are just like that, and they have to be like that. They're just fine, just like that. And we love them as beings, whether it's ourselves, perceptions of ourself, conceptions of ourself, or conceptions of other. And in that moment, we are born. In any moment that somebody else comes into our mind, they are born. In any moment that we think of ourselves, we are born. And whatever is born in that thought is like a newborn baby. This was my idea, why I wanted to call it conception. In that very moment when you're having another being or you as a being come into your mind, it's like a newborn baby. It's just right, just as it is. If it's crying or smiling, you know, people don't hate newborn babies when they cry. It's what a newborn baby does. People love newborn babies when they smile. But, you know, that very same baby could be crying only a moment later. So was the idea. We're constantly conceiving of beings within ourselves and outside of ourselves. And we can distinguish them just as they are and love them just as they are. So the next one is choice. The wisdom here is all accomplishing. I don't usually like to say a whole lot about this one. I've realized that it just gets me in trouble. It's associated with a double vajra, which is supposed to be something you're really not able to talk about. But I will say that to accomplish a thing is to move from point A to point B, and necessarily means that you may fail. Otherwise, it's not an accomplishment. There's something about this wisdom that is such that it can't fail, because it doesn't actually move from point A to point B. Because it doesn't conceive of a self failing in the future. The action is, I would say, perhaps you might say, spontaneously reoriented with every moment. So that the idea of a being moving from this moment to the next, and this moment having a task that fails in the next moment, doesn't even arise. So it always is accomplishing everything in every moment. In a more mundane sense, there's always a correction. There's always the potential for correction, so there's never the potential for failure. Even a correction is a success, you may say. Let's just say that's the more mundane way of putting it. Even the correction that has to be made in the case of a failure is a success. So it's an all-accomplishing wisdom. It doesn't impede action in any way. All action is a learning experience. And you could even say that there's no choice in it, even though it's the transformation of choice. There's no actual choice in it, because an ordinary choice is something that might fail, might go wrong. But this is not an ordinary choice. It's just an action that can't fail. And the last one is the transformation of self-centered consciousness. And this is known as all-encompassing or all-accommodating wisdom. So, if you're attached to the very idea of your existence, this is a separating out of the existence outside of you from the existence inside of you. And actually, this is the very nature of our consciousness. We experience our general unenlightened consciousness is such that we spontaneously divide ourselves from the world. And that's fine and very practical, but this unenlightened consciousness believes this to be a real thing, just a real experience, one that's somehow absolute and real in a way that then causes all kinds of confusion, because it makes you fall back on one of these other forms, one of these other things, form, feeling, conception, and choice. Either subconsciously or overtly, you fall back on thinking, since I'm here and the thing is over there, I must either be form, feeling, conception, or choice, thought or choice. But this all-accommodating wisdom doesn't do that. It accommodates or encompasses what is conventionally known as self and other in the same consciousness, which is really just a kind of clarity around the conditionality of the situation. And this is something that all four of these other wisdoms do, if you think about it. All four of these other wisdoms, in one way or another, avoid the selfing involved in that particular aspect of experience. Form, feeling, and I'm going to start saying thought now because that's what we know from the Heart Sutra. Form, feeling, thought, and choice. Form, feeling, thought, and choice. Form, feeling, thought, and choice. All encompassing wisdom incorporates all of those and doesn't land on any of them in any fixed way. Form, feeling, thought, choice. So form is the externalized idea of a thing. Feeling, thought, and choice are the internalized ideas of a thing. And self-centered consciousness is what bifurcates that experience. It's constantly, basically, thinking that there's a fixed self over here experiencing a fixed thing over there. There's a fixed thing in here experiencing a fixed thing out there. So in one way or another, these four other types of wisdom avoid that. And it's the all accommodating wisdom that balances and tunes us so that at any given time, through awareness, if we're fully cognizant of the thing that's catching us up, the thing, so to speak, whether it's forms, feelings, thoughts, or choices, it's this all-encompassing wisdom that allows for a kind of lucidity. Kind of lucidity and versatility. And optimally, all of this happens spontaneously. And in terms of a mythic context, all of these have their own kind of personalities associated with them, enlightened personalities. And each one of them can be a practice in its own right, because each one of them also include, because they're all Buddhas, they actually include all the other wisdoms. And so as a model for practice, it's interesting because you can think, for example, I get really caught up in how I feel, and so I'm going to take on the Buddha that is associated with the universal sameness of things. And if you look at all, I'm not going to get into the complexity of all the other aspects that is associated with these Buddhas, but if you look at them, they kind of have a way into all the other things. There's just sort of, they're all a complete practice by themselves. And if you get into imagining and contemplating what that Buddha is like, it in one way or another enters you into these other wisdoms as well. But also addresses the one thing maybe that you conventionally are having a problem with. So it's both conventional and ultimate at the same time. So it creates a context for you. Creates a context that is both right now somewhat incorporating the selfishness and leading you onward, as the Dharma is always supposed to do, leading you onward towards some other way of having a new mythic kind of context, a new mythic kind of happiness. I thought I would bring it all the way back to, I'm reading The Mindful Way to Self-Compassion, Stages of Acceptance, and that's the chapter, Stages of Acceptance. And this, I'm reading this book, and it's kind of a modern book about how to cultivate compassion and be aware, be more self-aware. And one thing I notice about books like this is they have a kind of highly therapeutic model. And this is just my impression, that it's written by somebody who seems to be mostly addressing relatively problematic people's lives and helping them move to relatively healthy, happy lives. Meaning it's not quite a mythic context. It's like how an unhappy marriage can become a happy marriage. You know, how somebody who is very nervous about public speaking cannot be nervous about public speaking. Right? Really helpful stuff. Like, I'm reading this book and thinking, wow, that's really helpful. All right? And yet, it doesn't create a mythic context. It doesn't point to some kind of mythic happiness that actually just transcends the whole model of unhappiness altogether. But, interestingly enough, it utilizes all the same principles as what I've talked about so far in this talk. So even basic therapeutic trends are mirrored in this larger Buddha mandala model. And I was just reading this today, and I thought I would read it. So here's the idea that you... that the way you accept and move on with very, very difficult things in life, and the example they gave was the death of a child, but I think it's applicable to failure in a lot of ways, or even anger at somebody for letting you down, or things that are very difficult to get beyond. So that's what's being pointed to here. So the first stage is aversion. Just pure aversion to the situation. You do not want it. And that can result in a lot of different negative emotions. That's the baseline. That's what we want to get out of. So that doesn't have any relativity to the model. But the first thing that you do in these stages of acceptance is move into a stage of curiosity, which is described as an undirected, non-judgmental interest in what's happening. And I very quickly saw the resonance between that and this first mirror-like wisdom. That you somehow get off the train of chasing your mind in circles and making yourself more upset about the situation by just stopping and being interested in the things just like this. Like, non-conceptual, what mirror-like wisdom, just what are all the aspects of what I'm experiencing right now, just like this. Anyway, I'm sure you can become curious in a lot of different ways, but I think there's a resonance there. And then the second stage, actually it's the third stage, the first one is aversion. The third stage is tolerance, which is very resonant with the notion of the wisdom of sameness. So you move into a stage of tolerance. You have some perspective on the fact that this hasn't always been the case, and it won't always be the case. I won't always be this way. You come to a stage of being able to tolerate the difficulty of the situation through perspective. The fourth stage is allowing, which this is, this was when I read this, it was what, in relationship to Donna Doss's talk, and you're just right, just as you are, kind of thinking, like it, it made me see that this is resonant with the distinguishing wisdom. It's like you actually see, yes, this is what's happening to me. I'm angry, or I'm grief-ridden, or I'm distraught, or I'm disappointed, and you allow it. At this point, there's more clarity. You're not just tolerating it. You're knowing what it is that you're tolerating in its particularity. And there's a sense of love around it, because you know that it's just right. It has to be right. This is what happened to you. This is what you know. This is how you feel. This is how you react. This is how it is. And the fifth stage is friendship. And the way it's described in this book, the allowing creates a space where you're able to move into and communicate more effectively with others, and A, be more receptive to their helping you, and B, potentially actually use the knowledge that you've learned through your allowing to be helpful to others, which actually gets you out of your rut. And he describes particularly the notion that there's a point at which people get a lot of benefit out of, say, if they've lost a child, which is a really intense experience to lose your child, the way it's described in this book, for sure, and I can imagine. You go to a group of other people who have lost their child, and they might be in one of these earlier stages, right? And you, apparently, it's incredibly therapeutic for that person who's gone through a bit more of it to help somebody else get through it. So there is a notion that there is this action-oriented friendship, as well as reception-oriented friendship. So it's part of a whole stage that can go from simply receiving help from a therapist or simply receiving help from a friend, another person perhaps who lost their child, all the way through to being the person that actually helps another person. So this is a stage in this acceptance, and that maps very closely, in the way I understand it, to this all-accomplishing wisdom. Because action in relationship to being connected and understanding others is an all-accomplishing action. It's a process of constantly learning about what's going on with somebody else. If you're in activity with regard to another being, you are receptive and taking in the feedback of whether or not you're helping them in any given moment, and you're being versatile to it. You're being lucid. You're saying, oh, maybe what I said wasn't helpful, and you're backing off, and you're saying, I'm sorry, maybe this will help. And each time you learn, you accomplish. So, I thought I would come back to that, because this is a model that's very accessible. Whoa, you have a bug. But if you include this model of the five Buddha mandala, it points beyond into a context that leads to something far beyond ordinary happiness, which is often the therapeutic model. Getting you back to work, getting you back to a regular day-to-day happiness with your wife, whatnot. And all of that is, of course, included. That's the great thing about this mythic happiness. It is not at the expense of becoming just a more happy, healthy human being, but it creates an unlimited ceiling for that, a point at which potentially you let go of all need, not necessarily experience, but need to have the ups be up and avoid the downs. So I think it makes sense also in terms of sorrow and the threat of all sorrows, because that's the kind of perspective that helps you understand that no matter how happy you get, it's all woven together with the world's sorrows. So, thank you.